Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. Next week, the University of New Mexico's African American Student Services Center will hold the Black Cultural Conference. On today's show, we'll hear from the two keynote speakers, Dr. Cleveland Sellers and his son, Bakari Sellers. Cleveland Sellers helped lead one of the most important organizations in the civil rights movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, commonly known as SNCC. In 1968, he was shot during the Orangeburg Massacre in South Carolina. Sellers was sent to prison, but was later pardoned. He has continued his activism and recently stepped down as president of Voorhees College, a historically Black university in South Carolina. His son, Bakari Sellers, is an attorney and former state lawmaker who's a frequent commentator on CNN. I spoke to Cleveland and Bakari Sellers by phone as their electricity was going in and out due to Hurricane Irma moving into South Carolina earlier this week. Cleveland Sellers, could you talk a bit about why SNCC was so important during that time in terms of mobilizing students and what lesson maybe student activists today can learn from SNCC?
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee came and brought in the talent and the tactics and the strategies that wasn't at that point employed by the civil rights movement and developed a sort of cohesion. The fact is that young people always bring a little bit more fire and a little bit more energy. They were fierce. They went into some of the most hostile areas to African Americans. So that's a good thing for many youngsters to understand that it doesn't take getting old and credentialed to make a difference and make a change. Many of our young people who came into the organization were 18, 19 years old, and some were even younger than that in places like Mississippi. What we were able to do is not only transform the movement itself, but it also transformed us. Because at first, we were involved with activities that involved ourselves. We called it putting ourselves in the movement and putting ourselves on the line. But when we began to move and shift to voter registration, it involved community people, local people, grassroots. We had to get them to agree to putting themselves in harm's way. And that's a tremendous responsibility. It certainly made many of us grow up much faster, because now we weren't saying that we were going to be out there and we would take the brunt, make the sacrifices and all of that. But now we were asking community people to sacrifice, make those sacrifices, because we knew when people went down to register to vote, there would be some consequences. Sometimes they would be shot at, arrested, or murdered. In some way, there would be some kind of retribution made on them. They would be thrown out of their homes. Any number of things would come as a result of them taking that particular step. But we had to encourage, and we had to keep the community organized and as protected as much as we possibly could.
Well, speaking of one of those incidents, you were shot during the Orangeburg Massacre when students protested against a segregated bowling alley in 1968. I don't think people are as familiar with this event as other events. Can you briefly tell us about it?
We estimate that there were some 40 students shot. One of the students that were killed was a 17-year-old high school student. So what it was it started out as a protest of a segregated bowling alley, and the students decided that in 1968, that was 4 years after the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, that they were going to go in and demand that bowling alley be closed or desegregated. They were met with resistance on the part of the owner and the local police. And the second night they went down, and not only were they rebuffed, but they were attacked. And there was a police riot in which many of the co-eds were injured. You had, I think, 13 that were hospitalized with concussions and lacerations of the scalp and that kind of thing as a result of a beating by State Highway Patrolmen and South Carolina Law Enforcement Division officers. The third day, there was a kind of lag, but during that period, two white youths got onto the campus and shot the campus up. We decided to sit down with the students and see what they wanted to do as the next action. On Thursday night, which was the fourth night, it was a cold February night, and they went out and they built a little bonfire in a street that was not utilized at all and stay warm and kind of, you know, keep the morale going. And at that point, the police decided to come in and put the fire out. And then they lined up a squadron of highway patrolmen with white helmets on. The students moved back away from the bonfire back onto the middle of an open field. And we are not certain at this point what caused the police to open fire, but they opened fire for about 8 seconds. And in that 8 seconds, they had wounded 40 students, most of whom were shot in the back and in the bottom of the feet and in the buttocks as they turned to move away from the police. So the shooting was very much like you would think of soldiers fighting in Vietnam. I mean, just gunfire, the smell of gunfire. You could hear people moaning and groaning as they were actually injured at that particular point. Then they sealed the campus off and restricted them from going to the hospitals. Later on that night, three of the students died. Milton, Delano Milton, was the high school student, and he was there sitting waiting on his mother, who was a custodian, to get off work, and he was going to walk her home. The police stood up on the side of the hill and just opened fire. I was in the group at the time when the police opened fire, and so I was shot in the left arm.
Yeah, you were convicted on a trumped-up charge and later pardoned, but I've read that you said South Carolina will not heal until there's an investigation into this massacre. Why do you feel that way?
They never did an investigation. They never did any kind of study. They never formed a Blue Ribbon Commission to find out what went on. The state actually told the story that the students were charging them. They didn't have any choice but to open fire on the students. They also said there was an exchange of gunfire, and the students who were on the campus were firing at the police. And then the other was that police weren't on campus. The police were on the campus. So we had to rebut all of that, but still the state never put together a committee to try to either seek the truth or find out what the truth was. We have tried to bring it up in the legislature and tried to bring it up in other places, but there has been no response on the part of the state. So I said that the Orangeburg massacre is a litmus test. If they don't deal with that, they certainly haven't dealt with the issue of race and race relations, not seriously, and they haven't dealt with the fact that the state was culpable in the shooting of unarmed students and shooting into a crowd of them on their campus. It is a litmus test for racial justice and peace in South Carolina. And to allow the healing to take place and move on with it. It's very similar to Does Black Lives Matter back in 1968. So I don't find it difficult to understand what happens in South Carolina with the police shootings and even young people in South Carolina believing that it's important for them to defend the old Confederacy and segregation and how you address those issues. As a racist young man went into the church in Charleston and killed the 9 parishioners. You have to address those issues. If not, they kind of simmer up under the surface and eventually they explode.
You're listening to University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamarek, and that was Cleveland Sellers, a longtime civil rights activist. We'll talk more with him in a moment about how the lynching of 14-year-old Emmett Till in Mississippi propelled him into action as a young man. He and his son, Bakari Sellers, will be at the University of New Mexico next week for the Black Cultural Conference. Find out more at KUNM.org. And while you're there, click on the donate button to keep programming like this on the air. You can also call in with a contribution. Here's the number,